Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back. My name is Seth Perler, and we are here with the Executive Function Online Summit. And I'm here today with Patty Lemmer out of the Northeast. And she has been working with kids and families for over 40 years now. And she's had a lot of her specialty has had to do with autism. And today she's going to talk about lifestyle choices. She's going to talk a lot about vision and how vision plays into this whole idea. So how are you doing today, Patty?
I'm great, Steph. How are you?
I'm so good. I'm so excited to have you here.
I'm honored to be on your summit. Thank you for inviting me.
You're so welcome. So tell us a little bit about what we're going to learn today.
So I've worked with people with all types of disabilities, as you said, for a long time. And executive function is a term that's come up a lot because of the problems that kids with attention deficits and learning disabilities and autism have. And so my approach has always been kind of heretical and thinking, well, what else could it be? What are some of the things that masquerade as autism and attention deficit and, of course, executive function? So that's what I'm going to talk about today, some of these masqueraders, so that parents can say, well, my kid does have a diagnosis of executive function, but let's look at some of the other possibilities. Is he getting enough sleep? What does he do with his spare time? What is he eating, drinking, breathing? So those are more lifestyle issues. And then there's some medical issues that we're going to talk about. Maybe he's on some medication. Maybe he has some kind of physical problem that could be affecting his executive function. And then we might talk about some sensory issues. The senses are, of course, how we receive information through our touch and our hearing and our vestibular system, which is our balance system. But the thing that I'd love to spend a lot of time on, because I think it's so misunderstood, is visual function. And what is vision? And how does it differ from eyesight? And how does vision develop? And how do kids learn how to use their vision? And what aspects of vision are involved in executive function? And how, if a child has difficulty with vision, how that would translate to difficulty with executive function.
Awesome. I look forward to learning about this myself. I always talk about what I call iceberg theory, where a lot of times we see what's on the tip of the iceberg, and right, we will see the grade suffering or outbursts emotionally or whatever is very easy to see. And then we do our best to address what we think is going on, but a lot of times we're missing what's underneath the iceberg, which is the bulk of it. And
I love that analogy. And I started out as a psychologist, and I was treating behaviors. And this question kept coming up: what's causing these behaviors? Why is this kid not paying attention? Why is he reversing his B's and D's? Why can't he organize his homework? Why is he having meltdowns when he knows exactly what's required and he's done this a million times? So I love the iceberg theory. And so I'm going to talk about what's underneath that iceberg.
Perfect. Perfect. So tell parents who you are, not professionally, but personally. What are you interested in, and who is Patty?
Okay. So Patty is known for kind of challenging the status quo. And I once wrote an article called When ADD First Came Out. It was ADD, did it stand for any dysfunction or disability? And was it really the emperor's new clothes? Because as you know, there's really no good test for ADD. There's no blood test or urine test. And although our brain scans are showing some aspect of brain dysfunction, it's different for everybody. And so that's when I got really interested in some of these things. And I'm a diagnostician at heart. I love looking for clues. And so Patty's somebody who is a diagnostician 24/7. And I'm always trying to figure out the puzzle. I love Nancy Drew mysteries as a child. And I now have a radio show called The Autism Detectives, where I work with, I have parents on my show who come on and say, well, my child had constipation, and I never had any clue that constipation had anything to do with autism, or my child was disorganized, or my child had ear infections, and my doctor treated those ear infections, but little did I know that down the road, those might have something to do with his learning and behavioral issues. So that's who Patty is. She's a questioner, and she likes to look for clues and try to find solutions that can help families and kids do better.
So have you always been like that even since a child? You said reading Nancy Drew, but even were you always someone who was just skeptical and thinking that there was more to the story?
Yep. It was always why? I wanted to know why things were happening. And I didn't like a lot of the answers. The answers didn't make any sense to me. You know, he can't organize his homework because he has executive function dysfunction, or he has attention deficit disorder. And those didn't explain it to me. It's like saying he has migraines because he has a headache. You know, it didn't tell me anything. So I wanted to look deeper and, as you say, beneath the iceberg. And the same history kept coming up, the same risk factors. These kids had many, many of the same problems early on in life. And I developed something called total load theory, which is as if you have...
Sorry about that, everybody. We just had a technical difficulty. You were talking about total load theory. What is total load theory?
So I developed this idea of total load where everyone has like a personal threshold. And if you do have stressors, these stressors add up. And so if a child has had ear infections and maybe eczema and maybe allergies, and then he has another ear infection and he takes antibiotics, he might go over his personal limit and have significant difficulty. And so any one of these things isn't going to cause serious problems, but as they all add up, the body is overstressed. And the body is like a bridge, and its number one priority is staying well. And so if it can't stay well, it can't listen and it can't pay attention because it's putting all of its energy into digestion and to clearing toxins and other things. So if you have a child who has a lot of medical issues or health issues and you want him to remember to pack up his backpack in the same way every day, he may not be able to do this because he's going to have some of the same technical glitches that this recording just had. And it's as he's digesting his food. And if he had something for lunch that was problematic for him, his body's going to say, honey, I'm not going to pay attention. I can't do my homework right now because that thing that you fed me for lunch, that grilled cheese sandwich, it's just too hard for me to digest. And that's what I'm putting all my energy into.
And he may not even have an awareness.
Correct.
That there are all of these little things going on. And then, as you said before, so we might have a label of ADD, but just having the label doesn't tell us about all these other things that can sort of be going on in the background, hidden.
That's correct. Correct. And so... total load theory helped me sort out for many kids what were some of these load factors that were going into his issues. And if we could peel the onion, we could get from above threshold down to below threshold, and even way down below threshold, where a child could then muster up enough energy to do the things that were required for him to focus on his homework and pay attention.
So how did you get into all this, and what's your professional background? Did you study to be a teacher at first, or?
No, I have a bachelor's in a combination of psychology and mathematics, because I was very interested in quantifying behavior. And so my undergraduate degree was in something called psychometry, psychological testing. So I was the one who you send kids to when they had neuropsychological, what was going on. And I was using these tests, which were rather silly with 20/20 hindsight, because they told me what I already knew, that the kid couldn't pay attention, that he had trouble with sequencing, that he had trouble with spatial relations, that he had trouble organizing his thoughts, and all things like that. But it didn't tell me why.
So as a diagnostician, you would use all of these tests that you were taught to use in university, and then you would put them through a series of a bunch of different tests and still come up with information, but it wasn't getting to the root of useful information that told us what can we do about it.
You got it. You got it.
And awesome. So, that's why I'm so glad you're here.
So that was my goal, was to then take a really in-depth history with the family and find out why the child had these issues that were showing up on my psychological tests. And I started out with kids with language issues, and it was clear that many of them had had ear infections. Some of them had had allergies. Many of them had had rounds and rounds of antibiotics. And we saw that over and over and over again. And then I got involved with nutrition. And a nutritionist I worked with said, "Well, Patty, look at the diet of all these kids. Do you think it's a coincidence that they're all living on wheat and dairy products? Every one of them has cereal and milk for breakfast and macaroni and cheese for dinner, and a grilled cheese sandwich or a bagel and cream cheese for lunch. And it's the same food over and over again." So I started researching, what does wheat and dairy do? Well, the gluten from the wheat and the casein from the dairy chemically combine to form an opiate. So, you know, we're in the middle of an opiate epidemic, but these kids are naturally drugging themselves with wheat and dairy products. And that science is very clear. And Karen Cerusi, who was a mother of a child with autism in the 90s, discovered that with her own kid and started putting her child on a wheat-free, dairy-free diet. And I took advantage of her findings and started talking to parents about, well, what would happen, do you think? And the parents would say, "He'd starve." Mm-hmm. And many of them were willing to try it. And sure enough, attention improved, health improved, sleep improved, appetite improved. Once we got over the hump, and these kids would actually eat salad, and they would eat Brussels sprouts, and they would eat strawberries and fruit in the summer. And all of a sudden, we had a healthier kid, but more importantly, he was paying attention. And the teacher said, "What medication did you put him on?" And we said, "Oh, it's called diet."
So the idea here is you have this threshold. One of the factors is diet. Yep. Two major things are dairy and wheat. You remove dairy and wheat, and you see in a lot of students that it seems like their threshold is changing, so that cognitively they're suddenly able to attend better, more clearly, and more effectively.
Right. So, and then a second thing was sleep. I mean, sleep was huge. These kids were terrible sleepers. They were night owls. They'd get a second wind. They couldn't fall asleep. And then in the morning, they couldn't wake up. And you know how early school starts now for kids. It's really terrible. Their parents were yanking them out of bed and dragging them to the bus. And they were not really there when they were in school. And then they'd wake up around 3 o'clock and it was time to go home. So sleep was an issue. How much video games they were playing was a huge issue. And we talked to the parents about limiting the number of video games and actually balancing out screen time with large motor activity, like some bike riding or swimming or ball playing of some kind. And that was very effective with a lot of kids. And so much so that some of these kids were able to stop taking some of their medications.
Mm-hmm. So before we get more into this, let's define executive function a little bit. So we have these parents that are coming to this conference because suddenly in our culture, people are starting to talk about executive function, where a lot of families used to do what we were talking about, see the tip of the iceberg. And from my practice, what I see a lot and why I think a lot of families are so interested in this topic is because they see their child not being able to do what needs to be done for school. And I talk about executive function in terms of getting stuff done. Now, the executive function is really a problem with getting stuff done that we don't want to get done. Like getting the video games done, is they don't have trouble executing with that. Right. But executing in order to execute on chores or schoolwork or responsibilities or goals, like getting a driver's license or things that end up being important, they can't do all the pieces to the puzzle. Or a college application is a massive thing to execute on. So right. What do you think is important about defining executive function within the context of your work?
Well, I think a couple of things. First is the actual sorting out the important thing from the background noise.
How do we do that?
So you help a child prioritize. You can reduce the noise by reducing clutter and have a specific place and time for everything. But I don't like organizing the environment as well as I like retraining the child from the inside out.
Got it.
And that is helping the child be able to say, oh, here's my backpack and there's my video game. But right now, my job is to organize my backpack. And the way that that happens is through a very complex sequencing of sensory bombardment of all the different senses. And this is hierarchical, where a child first develops touch and movement and smell and taste. And that's the way a baby develops. Eventually, a child is going to pay more attention to what he hears and eventually to what he sees. And so from a maturation point of view, we have to help our kids organize their touch and movement senses. And many of our kids are in occupational therapy because they are so kinesthetic in their approach to their homework and to even relationships and their belongings. So if they didn't touch it, it doesn't exist, because if they just look at it, they're not giving meaning to it. So a good occupational therapist recognizes this, and a good preschool teacher would recognize that a child needs to move to be able, and touch, to be able to know that, for instance, that the stove is hot. Mommy can say, don't touch, the stove is hot, you'll get burned. But how many little kids actually can do that? They have to get burned once.
So for you, executive function has a lot to do with, we're trying to get this stuff done. We have to figure out how to prioritize what to get done, but we have to really take into account kinesthetic, visual, auditory, these sensory things that are going on. And a lot of times parents and teachers don't have the background knowledge to know how to use this information.
Right. And if the child is still very kinesthetic, if he is not using his vision, if he is still using touch frequently to give meaning to his world, that has to be calmed down. It has to be calmed down in his nervous system. His touch and movement, he needs those experiences. And we don't want him to do it in class. We don't want him to be the kid who's wiggling all the time and who is throwing things and kicking his neighbor and going around in his desk looking for his pencils and his papers and his notebooks. We want him to eventually get those normalized so that he can open up his desk and find the notebook that he needs to put in his backpack. And in order for vision and auditory to emerge as primary senses, the child has to normalize the movement. And so one of the things that I recommend to parents a lot is to give kids a lot of exercise. Pretend their child is a St. Bernard puppy and get him moving before you ask him to settle down and do his work. And so it may be on a treadmill, it may be playing ball, it may be something else, big motor, but it's not a video game. It's not sitting.
That's one of the problems, right? Like kids come home, they'll sit down and start gaming, and then we expect that then they transition into homework. And there is no, and they're very sedentary. Well, Patty, let's back up. Let's go step by step through talking about sleep deprivation, executive function, screen time, then the food and sensory processing, and then vision. And then, does that sound good to go in that order? Okay. So we'll back.
We touched on a bunch of those though already. So
we did. We touched on a bunch of them. And then as you've been talking, what's been going on in my head is starting to say, well, how do we do this? How do we do that? Like thinking, what would parents say for the how? So let's talk a little bit about sleep deprivation. Maybe touch on it with anything else we need to know. And then tell us, how does a parent who's got a kid who's obsessed with electronics and wants to stay up in game or be on Snapchat or whatever, how do they get, or you have a high schooler who wants to stay up till 2 a.m. but has to be up at 5 a.m. for school. How do we start changing this? So let's dive into sleep deprivation.
All right. So the parent has to start with what we call a sleep hygiene program, and he has to be stalwart about it. You have to take away the electronic devices, have an absolute bedtime, the lights go out, you have a bedtime routine of homework is done by a certain time, 10 o'clock, the lights go out, you have a time to read, there should be no electronics within an hour of bedtime, the room has to be absolutely dark, and all chores are done. The child gets his drink of water. He gets a mother or father or a caregiver reads to him while he's quiet, and he gets in his own bed and the lights go out and it's over. And if he's not tired, he can just lie there. You can play some music. You can use some essences, oils to help calm him down, but he's in bed and he must try to go to sleep. And some kids at the beginning will take a couple hours for this to happen, but the time will get shorter and shorter and shorter if the parent is willing to be stalwart, and that's my word, about enforcing these parameters, which are what we call sleep hygiene. And the younger you do it, the better.
Yeah. Yeah, because by the time they're in high school, it's going to be a real battle.
Really, really hard. You don't have a lot of control when they're
in high school. So for parents who are starting with younger kids, really understand sleep hygiene and be just super consistent. And
yep. And
it's easier said than done, I'm sure.
What?
It's easier said than done.
It is easier said than done. And for the older kids, you sometimes, I think, have to find something that's a really meaningful reward for them. And many of them really want to do this.
I find that too.
They really want to be good. They don't want to have these executive function problems. And they would love to go to sleep. And what you're trying to do is retrain the whole nervous system. And by having it absolutely black and darkened in the room and having an uncluttered room with no television, no computer, no electronic devices, and natural bedding and all the different aspects of what help people go to sleep, whether it's white noise or any kind of soft music, you'll just keep searching for what works.
All
and
right.
And kids need 8 to 10 hours of sleep. And your teenagers who are trying to function on 5 to 6 or even 7 hours of sleep are way behind the eight ball. They are at such a disadvantage that when you are sleeping, you've got to go into deep REM sleep. It's the only time that your brain heals, that your body gets rid of toxins, that you are able to detoxify and clean out the garbage. That's when the garbage men come, when you're asleep.
So sleep is a major, major thing that gets you to the place with the threshold where you need to be so that I wonder sometimes, you know, for kids who look like they have attention deficit disorder or that really struggle with executive function, like I talk about the basic sleep, nutrition, exercise. Like if I had a magic wand, I would start with that. But to get the buy-in from the family, to get the parents to take the TV out of their room because the kid's going to say, well, why do you have one and I can't? Why?
Right.
You know, but it's a very complicated issue.
It's very complicated. And our parents,
those things are
deprived too.
Yeah. 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 It's very cultural.
It is.
Okay.
So that's huge. And food is huge. And
Let's get to screen time next.
Okay.
Let's do that one. So that was the second one on your list. So we go from the sleep deprivation. Obviously, we it's hard, but we learn what sleep hygiene is. We really work. What was the word you used?
Stalwart.
Spell that.
S-T-A-L-W-A-R-T.
Stalwart. You go at it stalwart.
You are determined. You're going to make it work. Nothing can convince you to give in.
Okay. And that's number one. And then we get to this screen time thing. So what are some of the key thoughts about screen time?
Screen time should have a limit, 30 minutes max, and at least an hour in between those 30-minute time periods. And parents have to figure out what enough is enough. An hour or two a day is a lot. But an hour or two a day in three or four 30-minute sessions is not as dangerous and difficult to the brain as a long period of time. And let the child choose. He can have 15, 20 minutes when he comes home from school. He can have some time first thing in the morning, but none within an hour of going to bed.
Now, I see, you probably do too, two sides to the spectrum. I see families who they're stalwart about this issue, and it's just there is no screen time during the week, or there's this much, and it's very structured and well thought out, and they are determined to hold that boundary. And there isn't much resistance around it because that's what's going on in the family. But then I have families where I've heard many, many, many families who will say that their kid will actually get violently angry if they can't get their screen time. Do you have any advice for some of those families who are starting and there's so much resistance?
Yeah, I think you've got to get buy-in somehow. And
what's buy-in?
That the child is willing to work with you. And I'm not beyond bribery. What is meaningful for him to comply? What is worth it for him to comply? Something you buy him, something you do together with him, a trip.
But they have to have some teeth in the game.
Right. And
I completely agree with you.
They have to have a reason to make a change. And if they don't want to buy in and it's not important to them, you will never win. You'll never be able to change it.
Okay.
And it has to have consequences. What are the consequences of not complying with this? And for kids over 6, 7, 8, you can be pretty rational. You can show them research on this, what screen time does to your brain, what lack of sleep does to your brain, that 3 days with not enough sleep, you become psychotic. 3 days without food, you can live. But you cannot live 3 days without sleep. And kids don't want to be bad. They don't want to be psychotic. They want to do well. And they want to make parents happy and make them love them. And the anger is at themselves. It's at the world. You know, it's not at you. Life isn't fair. As they feel better, as they're eating better, as they're sleeping better, as they're doing better in school, it will build. It does build, and they gain more confidence, and they see the results of their hard work.
And then how about food and environmental sensitivities? What is an environmental sensitivity for a parent who's never heard of that, and how does food fit into that?
So food, the whole question is, what is food? Are goldfish crackers and cheese doodles and Mountain Dew food? They're not. They're poison. They're chemicals. They affect the way the brain functions. And if you have parents who are buying this junk and eating it themselves, you're going to have a hard time convincing them that it does anything wrong, bad to their kids. But if you ever look at a bottle of Mountain Dew, it has 70-something grams of sugar in it. That's like liquid candy. If you eat something with MSG in it, it affects the visual cortex. The child can't pay attention in some cases. It affects digestion, and then the body again is putting its energy into digestion. So we want people to eat real food.
So what about a parent who is in a community where there really isn't a lot of great food around, and everywhere they go, all the restaurants are fast food restaurants, and all of the media that they're seeing are soda pop commercials and this and that. If they're pretty new to like hearing this kind of concept, do you have any tips for them?
Well, there are a lot of really good programs now in the schools and in the community that talk about what is real food. Communities are building gardens, community gardens. We're in the summer now. When this summit is in the middle of the highest harvest time. Go to a farmer's market. I have 4 farmer's markets within 5 minutes of my house. 4 days a week. Encourage parents to go to these farmers markets and buy the copious amount of fruits and vegetables that are there now. They can freeze them. They can dehydrate them. They can cook them, serve them, eat them. And nobody's going to love kale the first time they try it. But there's so many ways of using kale now. And places like Trader Joe's and Aldi's, which are not expensive grocery stores, are now carrying amazing products. I just bought a broccoli and kale pizza crust that Trader Joe's makes. That's outrageous.
So when you have a
cauliflower pizza crust.
And when you have a kid that says, like, I hate vegetables, I won't eat them. Do you have any thoughts on that?
All right, I'll pay you. I'll pay you $1 for every bite of cauliflower you eat. I'll pay you 20 cents, 10 cents, whatever's in your budget for every bite of cauliflower.
So just get it started, because the palate does change.
And he may just be able to smell it. He may just even be able to be at the table with it without barfing for the first couple weeks. He may not be able to get it in his mouth. He may just have to be in the same room with it at first.
I will say I had one teenager that I've been working with for a few years. He's the family's like a close friend now. And he, last year, he like eats a lot of Taco Bell is his thing. But he says, I hate vegetables. I hate vegetables. I always bring all these weird salads in because that's what I like. And he actually changed this year. By the end of the year, I'd be like, do you want some? And he'd be like, yay. Yeah. But the patience and the persistence. What's that?
I once saw a probation officer with hardened criminals who were coming to him on probation, and on his desk he had a Vitamix with green smoothie in the Vitamix. And these guys on probation were looking at him like, you gotta be kidding me, and I am not drinking that green stuff. And in a couple weeks he had them tasting it, and then they actually liked it, and then they started feeling better. And it's amazing the progress you can make if you're willing to stick with it.
And you mentioned environmental sensitivities. Can you tell us three environmental sensitivities? What does that mean?
Well, one of my first experiences with an environmental sensitivity was a mother whose kindergartner started acting crazy. And he was a pretty good kid who was not a behavior problem. And the teacher started sending notes home and saying, your child is having outbursts. And the mother went into the class to observe, to see what was going on. And she noticed that there was a new rug in the classroom. And she said to the teacher, when did this arrive? And she said, oh, a couple weeks ago. And she said, can we take the rug out and see if the behavior changes? And they took out the rug, and the child had no more behavioral issues. And they put the rug back, and he started acting out again. So the rug was off-gassing. Whatever chemicals were on the rug were now in the classroom. And the child's nervous system reacted to this little rug. And so that's not that uncommon. Yeah. And there are also kids who react to mold. Another one of my cases was a girl whose classroom moved to the basement of the school. And the basement of the school was moldy. And she started having terrible behavior problems. And she didn't have them at home, and she hadn't had them before. And we had a mold evaluation done, and sure enough, there was mold.
So off-gassing can happen from carpets, paints,
new cabinetry, any kind of new
furniture. So it's letting off. It's just been produced in a factory, and it's letting off all of these toxins.
Right.
Then you have your molds, your environmental molds, which can't be seen. I had a student who had a mold in his head for a long time, and they really struggled to work on that. But here in Boulder, we had a flood, and a lot of houses started having mold issues, and their basement had flooded, and that's when his started. So molds, off-gassing. Is there one other sensitivity?
Well, yes, the whole environment, the outdoors. You know, when you have pollen, the high pollen season, they give us up the pollen count of what the pollen is. Many of our kids in the fall, in the spring they have the pollen, and in the fall they have, as the leaves start dying, that's also affects many of our kids.
And again, from what you said before, like, these things can be invisible, we might not even notice
exactly
that's what's causing this, that's changing the threshold for them to be able to function well.
Right.
Okay, and great.
So many schools have all kinds of problems because the windows are closed all the time.
Yeah.
And they say that even as with the pollen and the mold outside, that the outdoor air is healthier than indoor air in some of the schools. So you never know what it might be in a school. It might be new tile. It might be, as I said, new cabinetry. Anything that's new has chemicals in it.
Okay. And let's start looking at, what is sensory processing?
So your body is constantly reacting to everything that is in your environment. So with all the senses, you know, if you have a new baby, that baby can be calmed by movement, by rocking, by touch, and by warmth. But if you run the vacuum cleaner in the baby's room, it doesn't do a whole lot to the baby, doesn't wake him up. A baby can sleep in a dark room or a light room. The visual aspects of the baby's room doesn't matter. So we have those early senses which are developing in a young child. And at about 4 or 5, we switch over from having control over our early senses to paying more attention to what's called our far senses. The ones that happen on our body are our near senses, and the ones out there in the environment, hearing and vision, are the far senses. So we want kids to develop and not go to kindergarten until they have control over their near senses, because we want them to sit still and pay attention. And pay attention means looking at the teacher, looking at the environment, and being able to pay attention to specific things and listening to and giving meaning to what you hear. And so occupational therapists often work with our kids who are younger to help them organize some of those senses. And then speech-language therapists and vision therapists work with kids who are having more auditory processing and visual problems.
So, Patty, one of the things that I see is, like, the more I get to know, for example, about OTs or vision therapy, the more I sit there and say, why? I was a teacher for 12 years. I taught multiple grades in multiple schools. Why did I never hear of this, or why wasn't? And it seems to me like this is so important, as I learn more about it, that it seems like this should be really a part of everybody's school. Like, it shouldn't just be the child who's having severe difficulties that happens to get evaluated by an OT and get services, but it seems like a need that I guess some kids probably develop it by chance better. So I don't know, but why?
It's a great question, Seth. And what happened in the olden days, before we had so many safety issues, is that kids got a lot of experiences with their near senses. When I was little, we played in the dirt. We went out in the woods. Mm-hmm. We walked around the neighborhood. We rode our bikes. We went and touched and moved all the time. kids aren't getting those experiences anymore. And these have been replaced with sedentary experiences, especially those with video games and with screen time. They watch television, they have electronic babysitters. And so kids have play dates. You know, we never had play dates. We played. And we got in fights and we got out of fights. We didn't have cell phones. Parents didn't know where we were. We were in the neighborhood somewhere and they knew we'd come back. So it's not safe to do that anymore. So because of safety concerns, we contain our children and they don't get the sensory experiences. So we need occupational therapy to give it to them in a controlled environment.
So for the parent... So for the parent that's watching, that's sitting there going, whoa, how do I even know if I should go down this rabbit hole? Where do they start?
Well, they can ask the teacher. Every school has an occupational therapist. Occupational therapy is what's called a related service. So the occupational therapist service is related to some kind of disability. So if the child has an IEP, or if he has a 504 accommodation plan, or if he has some issues, then he can get an occupational therapy evaluation for free in the school system. Now, a school-based occupational therapist is going to look for scissor skills, and is the child able to find his way around the building? He's going to look at some gross motor skills as they're related to school. But this occupational therapist might not pick up higher problematic sensory issues. Like if a child is having visual perceptual problems, and I want to get into some vision issues, or if a child's having handwriting problems, the OT will notice it, but may or may not get the visual component of it. So it may require that they go outside the school to a private person to do a private evaluation, which then can be taken to the school.
Okay. Is there a good website or book or anything that you like for sensory type things that people can get started with? Or well, do you have any articles?
I founded an organization in the 90s before there was an internet called Developmental Delay Resources. And I merged DDR into another organization called Epidemic Answers in 2013. And so the Epidemic Answers website, epidemicanswersplural.org, has dozens of articles on sensory processing where you can look up how your touch and movement and vision and auditory affect behavior and learning and attention.
Okay. Now let's get into the vision. So this is one of your biggest areas that you like to dive into.
It's my pet project.
Why? Why is it so important? Why don't we know about it?
Well, first of all, it was profound for me to learn that vision and eyesight were different things. I've worn glasses since I was six. And so I understood when something wasn't clear, I couldn't read it, and I certainly couldn't understand it. But I learned that that's just eyesight. When you say somebody has vision, that Steve Jobs had vision, that a head of an organization has vision to move that organization into the future, you're not talking about the prescription in his glasses. You're talking about something cognitive. You're talking about an interaction between the two eyes together and those eyes and the brain. So all the different aspects of executive function require efficient vision. And efficient vision is not easily distinguishable. When you look at me and I look at you, we can't tell whether either of us is using both eyes. I may be blind in one eye, but if both eyes look like they're looking at you, you can't tell me whether my brain is receiving information from both of those eyes. In order to have depth perception, in order to remember where something is in space, those two eyes have to work together and send the brain information at exactly the same moment so that that brain gets one visual image. If the eyes are working independently or not in sync, you get click, 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 click. And the brain is, oh my God, what's going on? What am I going to listen to? Do I listen to the left eye? Do I listen to the right eye? How do I know what I should put into my memory?
So is that the nature of the problem, is that the brain hasn't learned how to get the eyes to work in sync, essentially?
The brain hasn't learned is really an important line, because vision is learned. And how do you learn how to use your eyes together? Through movement activities. Those same movement activities that we have suppressed, that we have limited because of safety issues. So if a child has had deprivation in his movement for whatever reasons, because he was in an orphanage, because mama was a safety, compulsive about safety, don't touch that, don't go over there. Kids on leashes, you've seen kids on leashes in airports, so they don't, if a kid is a runner, you know, sometimes for safety reasons it's necessary. But if a kid's been in a car seat too long, if he's been in a backpack too long, he's been in these bumbo chairs that are so popular now, they're not getting their movement experiences. And movement and vision are like peanut butter and jelly. When you move in space, your eyes move with your body. And at first, your body moves where it goes and your eyes go with it. So little kids just move arbitrarily through space, and in kindergarten and nursery school, okay, here I am in the block corner. I'm going to play with blocks. But as you get older, you start using your vision to direct your movement. So by the time a kid goes to kindergarten, he might come into the room and take visual inventory and see, there's the block corner, there's the trucks, and there's where I paint. And I want to go to the block corner. So his eyes have directed him to the block corner. That's very, very different than the kid who is not taking visual inventory and whose body is just moving and he ends up in the block corner. Those kids you work with, those executive function dysfunction kids, many of them are still at a motor visual level. They haven't learned how to use their vision through their experiences. So we have to, again, do some kind of therapy with them. And first of all, we have to do an evaluation to see, are their eyes working together? Are those two eyes sending the brain the same message at the same time?
How does the parent or teacher know if the kid should even get an evaluation in the first place?
That's a great question. So sometimes it's obvious. Sometimes a child has an obvious eye turn, which has a fancy name. It's called a strabismus. So when you can see that in the child, that the
eyes... That's very visible, yeah.
That is visible. That child cannot be binocular. That child is not binocular. His brain is getting mixed messages. It may not even get a message from one of the eyes. The brain may say to that one eye, shut up. I'm not listening to you. Then he has what's called a lazy eye. That child may have had surgery on that turned eye. And that eye may look straight, but the two eyes may not be working together. Any child who is having any kind of learning, organizational, behavioral issues should have a very complete, what's called a developmental vision exam, which includes much more than just eyesight.
But those don't just happen at schools, right?
No, most schools give an eyesight evaluation. Can you see the E on the chart at 20 feet? That doesn't tell you, can the child read it? It can tell you only that he recognizes what it looks like.
Right, right. So a parent would have to go find a vision therapist or somebody.
First, an optometrist. We have three kinds of eye doctors. We have ophthalmologists who are MDs. They are trained as doctors whose training is to look at pathology. So if you have an eye disease or if you have an eye injury, that's where you want to go. But an optometrist has an undergraduate degree in some science and then 4 years, just like an MD, but he is 4 years of graduate school in a school of optometry are only for eyes. So he studies eyes for 4 years, and he studies the eyes in relationship to the whole body, the eyes in relationship to the brain, the eyes in relationship to movement. And so he's looking at how we use our eyes at every distance, at every 8 inches, which is a new field, a new visual field. And then some optometrists go beyond that, and they learn how to do vision therapy. And that's a special kind of developmental optometrist, and I can tell parents how to find one in their area. They can go to a website, which is C like Charlie, O like Onion, V like Victory, and D like Dog, COVD.org. And there's a big sign there that says find a doctor. And you put in your address and it comes up with a trained doctor in your area. Now, some of these doctors, if the school system is very enlightened, actually in California, some of these doctors are working with the school systems. In less enlightened states, you might have to pay for this, or if you're lucky, your insurance will cover it. Often, though, this is out of pocket. But if your child is having visual issues that are obvious, you can fight to get your insurance to pay for it very often.
So how do you help the visual issues?
So you do these visual therapy activities. Remember, we started with motor. That's how vision develops, through movement. So some of them, vision therapy is movement activities. It looks like you're moving through space. So you're using your body and your eyes together. It might start with someone with severe autism with just awareness, getting the child to pay attention to something as simple as a scarf that you throw up in the air and ask the child to catch it. A scarf is slowly moving. It's not like a ball. So it's intriguing to a young child. And you might work with bean bags or balls, and you might do it in very simple circumstances where you ask the child to catch a bean bag at a short distance, a foot or two. Then you might ask him to catch it with one hand or with the other hand or up here or down here. And you keep adding load factors to what the child has to do. Catch a bean bag while standing on a balance board. Catch a bean bag, and every time you catch it, say a number. 1, 2, 3, 4. And now we're going to do it. We're going to say backwards, count backwards from 10. 10, 9, 8. And then you can ask them to do it with the alphabet or the alphabet backwards. So you can keep making it harder and harder so that the body is thinking about the cognitive aspect of it and not being able to focus on the motor visual aspect of it.
Okay. So so I'll start getting to some wrap-up questions.
Can I say one more thing about the vision therapy? These optometrists also use lenses and prisms therapeutically. An ophthalmologist corrects eyesight, which is putting crutches on your eyes, which is what I've had. I'm wearing contacts now. But you correct the eyesight by putting crutches on them, which is what a lot of tutoring and therapy does. We help the child accommodate. We support the child. But what vision therapy does is it works from the inside out. And so we teach the eyes to work together. And sometimes they use lenses and prisms therapeutically. They're not correcting anything. They're disrupting a inefficient visual system so that the brain has to reorganize and reestablish a more efficient way of seeing.
Okay. Have you heard about kids who get tired from reading? Is that related?
Of course. And those are kids with inefficient vision. Their eye movements are not efficient. And they get tired because they're trying to hold binocular vision. It's like
the brain is working really overtime to accomplish this task that it shouldn't be working so hard to do.
Right.
Okay.
Sometimes we use lenses with them. We call them learning lenses that take some of the stress off. But more efficient is to strengthen those muscles so that those eyes can continuously send good messages to the brain. Any child who gets super tired when he's reading or working, that's telling you that he's visually inefficient.
Okay. All right, Patty. So you have a child at this threshold. They're beyond their threshold. They're using all this energy. You start working with them. You start to figure out that there might be some off-gassing. You deal with that. There might be some vision, some sensory issues, some sensitivities. And you really work with the family and you help chip away at these things. And you've taken, I don't know what, 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years, and have really seen a change. When you see a change like this, does it help executive function, does it help?
It absolutely.
That was a redundant question.
You're going to see the same gradual changes with executive function. You're going to find that that dumb little homework assignment that should have taken 10 minutes that you just spent an hour on, that the child can now do it in 15 minutes. And you're thrilled because you've taken off those load factors. You've released some inner chi, some energy in that child that he has been spending on working with this inefficient visual system and digestion, and his neurological system is trying to deal with all those load factors.
And you just mentioned the word chi, which you haven't mentioned earlier in this talk, but
energy.
Yeah, but what I'm asking is, are there any other alternative approaches that you want to mention on this talk?
I wrote a book called Outsmarting Autism. The book originally came out in 2014, and it was a bestseller, and I recently updated it and expanded it, and it came out in March of 2019. And this book has over 50 alternative approaches to help a child learn and behave and maximize his potential better. And the book is hierarchical. It takes you from the biology of autism through some of the sensory issues in autism, vision, and then into some of the techniques that a tutor or a coach would use. But I always want to look at those foundational skills. So there's reflex integration. That's a whole chapter in the book. Babies are born with over 100 different reflexes. Our environmental experiences limit those reflexes in some kids. So that's another therapy. Cranial sacral therapy, chiropractic, any kind of these hands-on body works therapies are amazing for many of our kids. And the book outlines all of these different therapies and gives websites and people that you can contact and references, and everything is scientifically based. It all has research behind it. This is not hocus pocus and Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. This is stuff that really has good efficacy.
I respond really well to sacrocranial, and I don't know why, but that's something, it just, when you're sitting there on the table, it seems so silly, but...
Like nothing's happening, right?
But it really helps.
It does, and it helps a lot of our kids, especially those who've had some kind of physical trauma, whether it's concussions from their sports or whether they had a birth trauma or whether they have had too much containment and not enough motor experiences.
All right. So I got two more questions for you today.
Okay.
The first one is this. What specific actions can parents take this week to get started implementing some of your approaches?
That's a great question. I would say look at one aspect of your lifestyle that you think might be problematic, whether it's the sleep, the screen time, or food. Those are the three biggies. And see if there are things that you can do to help make it more healthy. And pick one, and don't make a huge hurdle. And as I said, for some of these kids and vegetables, some of these kids and Brussels sprouts, it may be that the first thing that can just be on the table or in the same room. They can't get it near their nose or their mouth. And you want to just maybe have them do that for a week. And then maybe just smell it or stick their tongue on it. But start thinking of ways that you can make the diet healthier. The screen time diminish and have big motor activities. Go on a bike ride. Now the weather's so beautiful. Take a hike. Go swimming, go camping, do something that is more healthy. And how you'll see the benefits. You'll see that they'll be pooping better, that they'll be sleeping better. We want these kids to be exercised and exhausted so that they can fall asleep.
Awesome. I like that because we've gone into so many things beneath the iceberg. That helps narrow it. Just pick one little thing and start chipping away.
Yeah. And if they go to my book, and the book's available on Amazon, it's also available on my website, which is patricialemmer.com, L-E-M-E-R.
And we'll link to that.
My last name. And it's Outsmarting Autism has its own website. It also has a Facebook page that you can like. The book is available as a Kindle. You can get it electronically. And so there are lots of ways to look in this book and find ideas of what you can do. The book has an amazing index. I had a fantastic indexer. It's over 40 pages. So nobody's going to read this 600-page book from start to finish, but they will. Find it is a wealth of information, and it will be a reference book from prenatal through adults. I have a lot of information in it on adults and working with adults who, especially those with autism, but just because autism's in the title, don't be dissuaded. This book could be outsmarting ADHD. It could even be outsmarting executive function issues.
Okay, awesome. And then the final question is, and this has been my favorite question because the answers have been so fun, but from your heart to the parents that are watching, you've got these parents who are really concerned and they're on this because they're really looking for answers. But from your heart to these parents, what's the most important takeaway you hope they leave with right now?
That I know you're doing your best, and that feeling guilty that you might have missed something or that your child is having these issues is not worth your energy. This is not your fault. You didn't know any better. You're doing the best you can, and I know you're doing the best you can, and Seth knows you're doing the best you can, and we just want to give you some new options to add to your tool chest. And I hope that you'll try some of these new ideas. And I'm very confident that you will find that they will make your life a more pleasant place to live with some of these kids who can be super difficult.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Patty. I'm really appreciative of your time.
This has been great, Seth. Thank you. And I appreciate you having me on and the opportunity to talk about these things about which I'm so passionate.
All right. All right, parents, go take action. I'll see you in the next one.